This is Susan DeCamp, and my guest today is Vince Long, who is a technology education teacher at Senior High School. He also teaches drafting, and starting fall, he's going to be teaching programming at Senior High. Vince, thank you for coming in and talking to us today.
Thanks for having me here.
And the reason we had him come in and do an interview today was because he's an old radio show buff. The first question, of course, is how did you get into old radio shows?
Growing up in Los Angeles, I was exposed to a lot of radio. One Sunday afternoon, I was spinning the dial looking for some music and stumbled across a broadcast of The Shadow. And I was immediately captivated by a story told with sounds and no pictures. It opened a whole world to me. I had a reel-to-reel tape recorder that my father had given me. Just playing around with it, I decided, well, I'll tape one of these programs, and noticed that when I listened to the tape back, I could listen to it a couple times and the show didn't get old. In fact, it tended to get better. Unlike television, where you might see a show once or twice and that's it, radio tends to improve with subsequent listenings. So I started collecting more and more shows so that I could build up a small collection to just keep myself amused. And from there, I started collecting moderately serious, I guess, over the years. I have about 3,500 programs in my collection now.
What is your all-time favorite radio program?
That's really hard to say. It it depends on my mood.
It's like what's your favorite book, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess if I had to pick one, it would be the one that really got me into the program, and it would be The Shadow. This show has an interesting history in that it came from a magazine, actually. It was a pulp novel, and it was a character in a novel that was spun off into a radio program, and The Shadow was actually the announcer on the program, and eventually became the main character and became the person who could turn themselves invisible and go out and solve crimes. And that show in that form started in 1937 and ran until 1954, 26 shows a year. And the first Shadow was Orson Welles. And they went through three or four actors over the run of all those years. In fact, he was doing The Shadow when he did his famous War of the Worlds broadcast in 1938.
You've brought along a clip of The Shadow, and so we're going to play that famous, it's just the opening?
Yes.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
I don't think there's anybody who hasn't heard that particular "Who knows what evil lurks." In fact, I still hear people using that and referring to it.
It really became part of the culture, and there's still a lot of phrases in our language that originated as catchphrases on radio programs over the years. The Shadow is certainly one that even the younger generation knows of, even though, in addition, there was a movie made about it here a few years ago.
Well, you made the point earlier that a run from 1937 to 1954 is something to be envied. I mean, not even Seinfeld could come up with that, do you think?
No. And that was probably an average show. There's many programs that ran from the early 30s into the late 50s. Some of them made a successful transition to television, even.
Did they run in seasons like television programs do, where they produce so many and then replay them during the summer, or was it a new show every week?
Well, it was done as in seasons like we have now, but they didn't have summer reruns. They had summer replacements for the most part.
You spoke of the transition from radio to television. What time was that when the television really started giving radio a run for its money?
Well, I think radio really hit its peak in 1948, and it took a few years after the war before the televisions were manufactured in sufficient quantity to where they could threaten radio. And it was really television was available in 48 and became very popular in 1950, 51. And pretty much by the time we were into the mid-50s, radio was on its way out and television had taken over. But the last radio programs didn't go off until about 1961.
Name some of the programs from the radio that made the transition into television.
There's many of the popular comedians, such as Jack Benny, made a successful transition. There were dramatic programs. Suspense, which I mentioned here earlier, did have a run on television. Gunsmoke which many of us grew up with, started off as a radio program starring William Conrad, and is one of the better radio programs when you look back at what programs have held up historically. Gunsmoke certainly does. There was actually one program that made a transition from television to radio, and that was Have Gun, Will Travel. It was a CBS television program, and then they would port the scripts over to radio and rebroadcast them. And it was one of those shows that was done in the late 50s when there was still a gray area between radio and television and who was king.
With the same actor as Paladin?
No, they had Richard Boone played it on television, and John Daner played the part on radio.
Well, the Lone Ranger was a radio program, wasn't it?
That's right. Started off in Detroit at WXYZ, and it was developed by Fran Stryker, the owner of the station, who was trying to come up with programming that he didn't have to pay for, didn't have to buy from the network, and it became an immediate hit. And, of course, it made the transition to movies, serials, comic books, and television.
And we have a clip here from The Lone Ranger.
Horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver, the Lone Ranger. With his faithful Indian companion, Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse, Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Come on, Silver. Let's go, big fellow. I'll Silver. Hi!
Oh, I love hearing that.
And something you have to remember is that these shows were done live. They were not recorded ahead of time and pieced together. They had some pre-recorded sound effects that they would use, but these shows were done live every week, and if you made a mistake, it's what went on the air. Well, there was a perception at that time that if you pre-recorded something, it was somehow dishonest, and
really?
The public expected things to be live.
Talk about some of the roots of radio in vaudeville.
Well, radio did come from vaudeville. If you think of what it was like to live without television, radio, and maybe even without telephone, what did you do for entertainment? Well, we had silent movies when they came about, but even before that, people would go to a theater, and there would be for a variety of acts that would come on in the course of an evening, and these acts were actually very short, 8 to 10 minutes maybe. That's where a lot of the comedians and actors learn their craft. And when radio came about, a lot of them were afraid to make the transition. For one thing, if they used a vaudeville act, they could take it around the country and use that same act for years and years and never play the same town twice. Once they put it on radio, they need new material. So radio was a good thing for writers because we need a lot of content developed when we're using it up on a weekly basis.
And how about Fred Allen? Was he of a vaudeville background as well?
That's right. He was a juggler.
A juggler in vaudeville. We have a clip here of Fred Allen, and I understand he and Jack Benny had a sort of a thing going.
Yes, back in the 30s, Jack had a child on the show playing the violin, and the following week, Fred Allen on his show made a comment about it and made fun of Jack Benny. And so the week after that, Jack Benny made a comment on his show about Fred Allen, and this started the famous feud that lasted for years and years and years. And it became so popular that they even made a couple movies together that capitalized on this feud. One of them is called Love Thy Neighbor. If you have a chance to catch that on cable, it's very funny.
And so this is the setup, this clip.
This is Harry Von Zell, the announcer, is talking to Fred about what happened on Jack's show the week before.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, say, Fred, did you hear Jack say that you misinformed your radio audience? 400 people around the country?
He wouldn't know what it meant to cater to the 400.
Oh, and another thing I thought was funny was when he grilled little Stuart Kanan, the
another
boy who played...
Wait a minute. What was the first thing you thought was funny? Never mind another thing you thought was funny. What was... escalate that thing that was funny. What?
When Jack flew off the roof.
Oh, but you said about little Stuart Kanan, the...
Yeah, he grilled the little fella, you know.
Oh, that little boy who played the bee. Mm-hmm. Why that big bully picking on a little fella like Stuart? Why doesn't he pick on somebody his size? He's the kind of a guy who gives Shirley Temple a hot foot.
Oh, that's great. Now, the radio was the originator of the sitcom, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. The entire format of the sitcom developed in radio and was very well developed in radio. And even that was has its roots in vaudeville.
What were some of your favorites of the sitcom format of radio show?
Well, I think one of the best sitcoms was the Great Gildersleeve. It was actually a spinoff. You know, in television, we have spinoff programs, and that came from radio as well. There was a program called the Fibber McGee and Molly program, which was a husband and wife act, Jim and Miriam Jordan. And you want to talk about a show that's about nothing? This was the Fibber McGee and Molly program, as well as the format for Jack Benny and many other programs. Seinfeld had nothing new going here. And one of the characters on the Fibber McGee and Molly show was Throckmorton P. Gildersleeve, and he was so popular that he got his own program in it, and I think it is best, one of the best examples of sitcom that came out of radio. Why I brought this clip is that it's a good example of what radio was about in terms of it's not a visual medium, it's words. And they had Don Quinn, the writer on this program, was just a master of it. And so it's a repartee between Fibber and Molly that goes back to the type of routine they did in vaudeville.
Okay.
Was that George Gallup?
No, Charlie, a fellow I used to know in the circus.
No.
He used to play the cantaloupe in the parade.
No, you don't mean cantaloupe. You mean he played the calamity.
Molly, a calamity is something bad.
Well, I never heard one played good.
One what?
One of those steam pianos, those antelopes.
That's right if they hate antelopes. Antelopes are kind of dear.
I don't care how much they cost, I don't like it. And for your information, dearie, a cantaloupe is a mushmelon.
Of course it's a mushmelon, I know that.
Well, how could anyone play a mushmelon in a circus?
Charlie did. Bored holes into it and played it like a sweet potato. It was a little drippy, but it had rhythm.
I was expecting a closet. A closet.
Yeah, he's famous for his closet. That was one of the pieces that they didn't do it every week, but Fibber McGee was very famous for having a very cluttered closet, and he would all of a sudden in the program say, "Hey, let me go get such and such. I've got it here in the closet." And Molly would say, "Don't open the closet." And he'd open the closet, and then the sound effects man would take over and make a real racket of things tumbling out of the closet.
Oh, I always loved that. I thought that'd be the world's greatest job, you know, sitting back there making all that noise. Another one of the most famous and the most popular sitcoms on radio was Amos and Andy. That's controversial even now. I just read something recently about Amos and Andy and wanting to revive some of the series and how it's gone back and forth within the African-American community. How did you like Amos and Andy?
It was a wonderful program. It was very funny, and especially taken in light of when it was produced. The show started off being called Sam and Henry, and it was two white actors did the writing and played all the parts. And eventually they moved to another radio station and didn't own the name, so they changed it to Amos and Andy, and essentially the show was the same. And the type of humor comes out of vaudeville again, and during the 20s and 30s and 40s, ethnic humor was accepted. And there were shows that featured Jewish characters and Greek characters and Russian characters and Irish characters and things that we wouldn't do today on television because of political correctness. And so when you look back on this, this is a trip down into American history. And the particular clip I brought has two of the characters having a discussion. The Kingfish is a con man, and he's trying to con his friend Andy into buying a gun. And so to get him to buy the gun, he's trying to make him fearful of a supposed axe murderer that's running around town. And so he's first going to deputize him and give him this card that makes him an official deputy.
Set up to the comment, a reference to the police force in New York City before this.
At the end of the clip, he'll say it's an official police card because it has a pair of crossed rubber hoses on a field of shamrocks on its seal. So you have to say, well, what are crossed rubber hoses? What does rubber hose have to do with the policeman? Well, they have to go back and look that the police had a reputation for beating the confessions out of the accused, and they would use rubber hoses so that they wouldn't leave a mark on the body. And then the rubber hoses are on a field of shamrocks, and New York police officers were predominantly Irish back in these days.
And so this was a real turnabout in one sense, a program that would be considered not very complimentary toward black people, and here they were making a shot, taking a shot at the Irish cops at the same time.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, say, you know, he can do more damage with that than a Boy Scout.
Yeah.
Say, but,
wait a minute. There must be some way we can protect ourselves, Kingfish.
Yeah, wait a minute. There is, Ander. You know, we are swearing in every able-bodied man as a deputy sheriff that we can get a hold of.
Yeah, well, whatever it is, conclude me in the thing, Kingfish.
Yeah, well, now, I know you'd feel that way, Ander, and I've already had the official card made out for you saying that you was a deputy sheriff. Now, here's the card right here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, King.
Yeah, you know how the thing works, of course.
Oh, sure. If the killer tries to hit me with the axe, I shows him the card.
Let me lead you to the thing, and I just go.
Yeah, what do I say?
They say him, a deputy sheriff. This card entitles him to carry a gun and blast away at any and all persons within the confines of the city.
Hmm. That's the official card.
Oh, certainly, yeah. Look at that. There's the official police department seal up in the corner there. Two cross rubber hoses on the field of shamrock. See it?
Oh, man. That's some biting commentary.
That's right. They weren't afraid to use that in their humor back in those days. And the radio programs of the 30s and 40s are just full of that type of stuff.
Charlie McCarthy was another program that I think a lot of people think about when they think back to radio. But Charlie McCarthy was a puppet.
Right. Edgar Bergen was the ventriloquist and had been a very popular act in vaudeville and came into radio in the early 1930s. And no one really paid attention that we have a ventriloquist doing his act on radio. And Edgar Bergen was known for moving his lips anyway. It's just the material and the characterizations he did were so good, it didn't matter if it was radio or on stage. And his daughter went off to a bigger, better thing. She used to be on his program when she was a little girl, Candace Bergen, who's retiring from Murphy Brown.
Oh, I read one time that she was jealous of the peppet.
That's right. It drove her crazy when people would refer to Charlie McCarthy as her brother.
You see, Charlie, the mess we're in now only proves the old saying that for every lie you tell, you have to invent 20 more.
20 more, yes.
Well, I think I'm the guy that can do it, Julie.
You certainly are. Don't you ever, Charlie, don't you ever get the impulse to dispense with lying?
Yes.
You do?
Mm-hmm. But I usually manage to fight it off.
Yes. Well, why?
I don't know. The truth and I just don't get along. Incompatibility is quite a scandal.
Oh, yes. But, Charlie, you must force yourself to tell the truth.
Yeah?
Yes.
Why?
Why?
Yeah. I asked you first.
Yes, I know. because the truth is beautiful.
It is?
Yes.
Beautiful?
That's what it is.
Ain't I ugly?
Yes. See, Charlie, it's wrong to tell a lie, even a white lie.
Oh, I don't bother with those white lies. Mine are all in technicolor.
Yes, I know.
Did Edgar Bergen write all his own material?
No. Most of these radio programs had a staff of writers. It would be difficult for one person to crank out the material. He did contribute to it, just as Jack Benny did. Probably the one who's known for writing the majority of his own material is Fred Allen.
Oh, really? He did write the majority of his own. And this next clip is one you referred to earlier. It's Fibber McGee and Molly. Their program gave rise to the character, the Great Gildersleeve.
Yes.
And then he spun off into his own program.
Yes, and in the program, he's the water commissioner, and he's kind of a blowhard kind of character, has a very unique voice and laugh. In this particular clip, Fibber McGee and Molly have come for a visit from their town, and the Great Gildersleeve, he has a nephew and niece that live with him, and early on in the series, there's the story about how he gained custody of them. The show ran for many, many years, and the actor, Hal Perry, who's playing the Gildersleeve in this clip, eventually wanted more money and more notoriety, and the network said no, and so they got another actor to play his part that imitated his voice, Willard Waterman, who did an excellent job for many years, and Hal Perry kind of slipped into obscurity.
Oh, yes. Come here, my boy.
Well, this must be little Leroy.
Yes.
Leroy, I want you to meet Mrs. McGee, a very dear friend of mine.
How do you do?
My, he's a fine-looking lad, Mr. Gildersleeve.
Oh, and this is Mr. McGee.
Hi, bud. Gosh, I had no idea you were such a big kid.
Gosh, I had no idea you were so big either.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you're not such a little runt. Hunk told me...
Leroy!
First there was Fibber McGee and Molly, then there was the Great Gildersleeves program, and then Great Gildersleeve has Fibber McGee and Molly on his program.
That's right.
I think that's so wonderful. It's like having a neighborhood on radio. You knew all the characters, and like they might be up and down the street from each other, but you really kind of got an audio image of community.
That's right. And it was very common to do this type of thing, characters sharing with one another from radio programs to another, and it's something that's just not done anymore.
And most of this came out of New York?
Well, it was about half and half there for a while. And what was interesting was that they broadcast each of these shows twice, once for the East Coast time and once for the West Coast time. And so they would sometimes they tighten the script up and fix some problems they had. So a lot of times the West Coast program was always a little better. Of course, there's a lot of stories about how between the programs, when they had to wait for the clock to run between the shows, what do? Well, they'd go across the street and have dinner and maybe drink a little bit. And a lot of times the second show was a little looser than the first show.
A little more hilarity there.
Yeah, that's right.
What were some of the other kinds of programs that were popular on the radio?
Well, of course, music was a big piece of radio as it is now. They played records, of course, but the popular thing was band remotes, where the famous bands of the day would broadcast live. And this was very common to be able to turn on and hear Glenn Miller playing, or Woody Herman, or Benny Goodman playing live most evenings. And then there were music programs, such as these countdown programs, tell you the latest and greatest hits, and your hit parade.
That was really long running, wasn't it?
That's right. Ran for many years. And I believe that may have made a transition in some form to television.
And which is this particular clip of your hip parade?
This is the introduction. She gives you a little flavor of what it sounded like when the show started on.
Okay.
Your hip parade. The lucky seven songs of the week with Snooky Lance and Eileen Wilson, Dorothy Collins, the Hit Paraders, and Raymond Scott and Orchestra. And off we go with your Hit Parade. Eileen Wilson and the Hit Paraders get the show underway with a happy-go-lucky tune that's number seven on the survey.
Well, there's a little walk down memory lane for anybody who's old enough to remember that.
That's right. News, of course, was a big part of radio, and that was something new for the public. They got most of their news from newspapers. Radio and newspapers were in competition head-to-head. And in fact, because of the Hearst Corporation threatening the wire services, radio had to set up their own news departments. And that's why we have CBS News and NBC News now, because they were forced to compete with the newspapers and set up their own news departments. This one clip, which is very famous, it was not actually broadcast live. A newsman, Herb Morrison, had a new piece of recording equipment, and his engineer wanted to try it out and see what it worked, how it worked in the field, this new portable equipment, when essentially it was a record-cutting machine. So to practice with it, they went to Lakehurst, New Jersey, to cover the landing of the Hindenburg, which was a large airship filled with hydrogen docking at its place in Lakehurst, New Jersey.
It's practically standing still. Now they've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Keep out of the way. Get it started. It's crashing. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning and bursting into flames and it's falling on the mooring fast and all the folks between us. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's crashing. 20, oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now. And the frame is crashing to the ground. Not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers screaming around. I don't...
I can't talk to people whose friends are out there.
That's so awful.
He had the presence of mind to keep covering the event that he didn't know was going to happen. And he goes on for another minute or two, and then he just loses it, and they stop the recording. And he composes himself and comes back on, and the entire recording runs about 20 minutes. And I've heard the whole recording, and he does go back, and he interviews survivors and does a great job. And then that disc was put up on the networks that day, and it was played over and over, and it became part of the culture at the time. Everybody knew Herb Morrison. They knew his voice.
Was he well known when this happened?
No, he was just
that
a
launched
he was,
him then too.
He was a local newsman, and he never became a huge anchor man or anything like that. He just was a hardworking news guy, and he died here not too many years ago. He passed away.
Other great events, you know, that have happened in our history are really we kind of know them through the radio and the sounds and the words, and not so much the television images. And do you think that helps in a sense? That we remember them better, or does it change the way these things stick in our mind?
Well, I think when you form the pictures in your own mind, they become a little more permanent because you were an active participant in creating them, which is why I find radio so much more powerful than film or television, as it's called the theater of the mind. Probably the thing that brought the nation together the most during World War II was the radio. It was that one unifying force that could allow people to share this one common event.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
That has got to be the most heard statement of all time.
The president was a master at using radio. He had been doing his fireside chats for many years, and so he knew the power of the medium.
Well, what else have you brought in for us to listen to?
Well, one of the things that radio covered, of course, it covered sporting events, and so the World Series and was covered, and I didn't bring any sporting clips in, but one thing radio did have that we still have today are commercials. And there was a lot of controversy about the content of the commercials and the number of commercials, not unlike what we hear now. And, of course, the standards are a little different. And finally, the broadcasters got together and came up with their – they were afraid the government was going to come in and regulate the content of commercials. And so they set up their own standards. And this was in effect until really just a few years ago when they chucked all that out. But
oh, really? We have no standards anymore?
Well, not their own.
Funny, this doesn't surprise me.
The clip I brought in is for Arid, which is a deodorant, and listen to the way the announcer talks about the problem that it's trying to solve, and they really try to soft sell it to get it past all the network sensors.
What date is this from?
I believe this is from the late 30s or very early 40s.
Arid 2 is helping thousands to solve the important personal problem of underarm perspiration. Arid helps you avoid perspiration damage to clothes and safeguards friendship. Use Arid every day. It helps stop perspiration safely, and at the same time, Arid is a most effective deodorant.
Well, I'm all for safeguarding friendship.
You didn't know you could get that in that product, though, did you?
That's pretty nice. And I think one of the most famous and even controversial at the time radio programs was War of the Worlds.
This is right. This is October 30th of 1938. Orson Welles had a program where he generally did famous works of the stage. He did Shakespeare and he did Dickens. And on the night before Halloween in 1938, they decided to do War of the Worlds. But being the kind of guy Orson Welles was, he changed the format of the program. Instead of just being a story of how the Martians came down and took over the Earth, he did it in the form of a radio broadcast. And he knew exactly what he was doing. The announcer who would cover the landing of the Martians had listened to Herb Morrison's Hindenburg recording over and over to get the cadence of the voice right. And, you know, that had only happened the previous year, so it was in the public mind. Here we are, we're a year before World War II breaks out, and so the public has got invasion on their mind. Wells did this really to say boo to the American public.
Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but it's becoming more distinct. Perhaps you've caught it already on your radio. Listen, please. Do you hear it? It's a curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object.
Right.
I'll move the microphone nearer. Here. Now, we're not more than 25 feet away. Can you hear it now? Professor Pearson.
Yes, Mr. Brooks.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
I don't know what to think. The metal casing is definitely extraterrestrial. Not found on this Earth. Friction with the Earth's atmosphere usually tears holes in a meteorite. This thing is smooth, and you can see its cylindrical
shape. Just a minute. Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and the thing must be hollow.
Keep those men back!
Come on,
keep those idiots back!
Get
off! The top
blew!
Look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone or something I can see turning out of that black hole, two luminous disks. And the eyes, it might be a face. Might be almost. Good heavens. Something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one.
Well, take that, X-Files.
Wells had timed the show to where the most popular show on the radio was Charlie McCarthy, and they always went to a commercial at the same time every week. And he timed the production of his show so that when people tuned out of Charlie McCarthy and did some channel surfing during the commercial, and channel surfing isn't new to television, they would tune into CBS and they would hear this broadcast. He took a lot of heat for this. The papers reported about people committing suicide and such, and it was the Hearst newspapers that were reporting this because they were in competition for news with radio. And William Randolph Hearst really tried to make Orson Welles the scapegoat. Of course, Orson Welles got even a few years later when he made his movie Citizen Kane.
I didn't know the two were connected.
What's been interesting in the last couple of years is how the Internet has figured into as this new piece of technology merging with this old piece of technology. And I'm able to trade programs with people that I meet on the Internet. And we,
old radio on the Internet. I love that.
Yeah, we actually can download programs from one another. But probably the more popular way is to meet people who have a collection. You share your lists with one another. Mine is actually on my webpage, so I get email from people all the time who say, hey, you want to swap some copies of The Shadow? And so usually what you do is you say, I'll send you these five, and you send me those five, and we trade them with cassettes through using conventional mail.
Oh, really? And what about copyright restrictions on some of this stuff?
Well, that's a controversial topic in itself. And I belong to a list server, which is a discussion group on the Internet. And about once a year, the subject of copyright comes up. And we've got many lawyers in the group. And, of course, they can't all agree. Generally, the copyrights have expired on many of the things in the programs, but sometimes the music hasn't expired, or maybe there's no copyright on the broadcast rights, but maybe on the writing. So there are many things in the show that had to be copyrighted. The way it really stands now is if you're not using the show for commercial purposes, if you're just sharing them with others, even if you're broadcasting them as we're doing today, that's not a problem, and no one's getting upset about that.
Well, that's a relief to me. Well, thank you so much for bringing in this wonderful collection of our old radio programs.
Okay, thank you for having me.
This has been Susan DeCamp, and my guest today is Vincent Long, who is a teacher at Senior High School. He teaches technology education, drafting, and starting this fall, he's going to be teaching programming. Do you ever have an opportunity to use any of your radio programs in the classroom?
Sure. In my technology education class, I've used the history of broadcasting as a way we look at the history of technology. In technology education, we try to look at the impacts of technology, especially when different technologies compete with one another. For instance, print media competing with broadcast media. And so the story of War of the Worlds really is a good way to illustrate that.
My guest today has been Vince Long, instructor at Billings Senior High School, and this is Susan DeCamp. Thanks for tuning in, and you've been listening to Yellowstone Public Radio.
You're tuned to a Yellowstone Public Radio station. KEMC, Billings. KBMC, Bozeman. KECC, Miles City. Or KNMC, Havre.